The tale of the beautiful game governed by an ugly monster.
They wanted to be a force for good.
The lines between right and wrong blurred.
Wire fraud, money laundering,
racketeering,
tax evasion.
FIFA became a criminal organization.
Mr. Blatter!
You're looking at 75 years in jail.
You are innocent until declared guilty.
Well, the FIFA World Cup in Qatar is in the crucial knockout phases. Quarterfinals are on at the weekend. There have been shock exits, Germany and Belgium out. It could be argued that football itself has taken a corner, overshadowed by the corruption that should have earned governing body FIFA a red card in the lead-up to this World Cup, and also the last one in Russia, and indeed others since that first tournament was held in Uruguay in 1930. All this is according to a Netflix expose series, FIFA Uncovered, which tackles how football, sponsorship, politics, money and power all came to be in the same squad, and asks, how did Qatar get the hosting rights? Was it the fighter jets or the gas deal? FIFA Uncovered writer and producer Miles Coleman has exposed FIFA's unseemly moments, having been granted full access by FIFA to its archives and securing a very candid interview with controversial FIFA past president Sepp Blatter. Miles is our guest now on 9 to Noon. He's with us from London. Kia ora, hello, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm going to try this. Kia ora, I hope I got that right.
Very good. You know, it's always good to hear people giving it a go. First of all, we should probably talk a little bit about the football. I think you've been watching the game that's just finished, Brazil-South Korea. What did you make of it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always nice to have an interview scheduled where I can walk home from the pub having just finished watching the game. It's very nice to see some good football being played. And I hope that, although the rest of our interview will probably talk about the less salubrious side of football, that everyone in New Zealand is still managing to enjoy the beautiful game, even though it's less fun without the All Whites in it this year.
Yes, indeed. The All Whites not quite making it, maybe next time. However, for this series that you have made, it's much more, not so much about the football and the on-field antics, it's all about the back room, I suppose, and FIFA, the governing body, being the one in the dock.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, on the team that made this, we're all huge football fans. I'm a very big football fan. And our kind of sweet spot, our bread and butter, is football documentaries. And that normally focuses on what happens on the pitch, goals, players, managers, tactics, that sort of thing. But there was a rumbling that we had for many years that kind of all wasn't well off the pitch. And although it's not as kind of attractive a subject matter in some ways, you know, the politicking and the gentlemen that run the game, we think it was a really important subject, especially now when this is going to be the most controversial World Cup in history. So it was a sort of almost a necessary evil, I think we felt, to tackle it as a subject.
When you were beginning to take a look at FIFA, I guess you approached the organisation, and what was their reaction?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. The current FIFA consider themselves to be legally, culturally, ethically, utterly separate from the FIFA that went before them. And really the line in the sand there is 2015. 2015 being the year where various FIFA executives were let out from five-star hotels in handcuffs. 2015 is the year that Sepp Blatter stands down too. And the current FIFA would argue that not only are the personnel different, not only is the leadership and the president different, but that, you know, they've undergone this kind of radical shift in culture. And what they would argue too is that their FIFA, the current FIFA, is not a sort of, far from being a continuation, it's actually a victim of the old FIFA. That's very much their argument. It's that old FIFA corruption under Blatter has sort of hampered the current FIFA, and that FIFA, as a victim, are entitled to compensation. And they're essentially suing the old FIFA. So to answer your question, when we said to them we want to do a documentary that looks at the sort of the FIFA corruption and these 2015 arrests and the Qatar World Cup, the current FIFA sort of went, well, we agree they were corrupt, which might surprise a lot of people to know that.
Indeed. So FIFA was founded back in 1930. When did it all begin to go off the rails?
Yeah, I mean, you know, FIFA itself traces its roots even further than that. And I guess as for the first years of FIFA's existence as a very amateur organization, football itself is amateur, a lot of sport worldwide is amateur. You know, the first World Cup is organized in Uruguay, and there are all these very quaint stories about teams getting there by boat, you know, one team getting a bit lost en route and not really making it. And it's all a far cry from where we are today. The moment that our documentary looks at as a sort of turning point, as the first fork in the road, if you'd like, in the FIFA journey, is 1974. That's the moment when a Brazilian by the name of João Havelange, an industrialist, son of an arms dealer, challenges a British football administrator by the name of Sir Stanley Rouse for the presidency. Up until then, presidential elections are relatively meaningless, very good-natured. You know, they're sort of rotated around these friends who are all European as a kind of, you know, it's almost like being the secretary at the local bowls club. If someone puts their hand up and goes, oh, I'll do it this year. And for the first time, someone goes in with not only a presidential challenge, but a very different election campaign. What Havelange says is he's sick and tired of the Europeans running the game as if it was theirs. And he tries to band together countries in the global south and South America and in Africa to sort of take FIFA down a different direction. And one of the things he says is not only should countries in the global south get more prominence, but also he believes that more money should be coming into the game, that programs should be financed and paid for to develop football around the world, which sounds like an awfully good idea. And I don't think many people could complain then or now. But what's interesting is he opens a sort of Pandora's box of money and politics coming into football. And that's really the kind of, I guess, you know, to use a tortuous football metaphor, that's the starting whistle for our documentary and where FIFA goes down a very different path.
And so how powerful did FIFA become?
That's what blew my mind making this, is I knew FIFA had power in football. But I really thought that's where it ended. You know, FIFA could decide if it was a goal or not, if it was a red card or a yellow card. But I never really understood until we started looking at the history of FIFA, the political power that FIFA had outside. Let me give you an example. In history, there have only been two buildings ever with diplomatic immunity that are not embassies. So, of course, embassies have diplomatic immunity. The British Embassy in New Zealand will have some sort of diplomatic immunity. The only two buildings in global history that have ever had that diplomatic immunity have been FIFA buildings. The head of the South American Confederation in Paraguay, which has no longer got diplomatic immunity. And today, the only building in the world with this diplomatic immunity is the head of the African Football Congress in Cairo. And FIFA presidents were basically the only people in the world that I can think of that could walk off any runway, off any private jet in the world, into an audience with any head of state they wanted. Why? Because football is an immensely powerful tool for governments and for regimes, both liberal and illiberal, to spread their message, to get goodwill. And FIFA presidents really operated like amateurs, like, you know, sort of have-a-go statesmen. And that was one of the things that I found absolutely astonishing. And we can, you know, I'm sure we'll get on to talk about the Qatar World Cup. Mm. But I think people would be amazed to find out just the level of politicking. In your introduction, you mentioned fighter jets being, you know, tossed around as part of World Cup boats. That's precisely right. That happened.
Yes, tell us
and
about
that. And I think that will surprise a lot of people. Mm. Well, I mean, yes, we're sort of jumping ahead in the timeline. But I mean, that quite literally happened when the French voter Michel Platini was being courted by the Qatari bid to host the World Cup. There were deals being done at an intergovernmental level that went well above Platini and went to the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy. And after Qatar was awarded the World Cup, we started seeing these awfully strange things happening, like the government of France selling the government of Qatar actual fighter jets. And so to answer your sort of, you know, initial question, how powerful is FIFA? I think far more powerful than anyone could have imagined.
Indeed. So some of the corruption that goes on is quite mind-blowing. Some of the examples that are in the series, I mean, it reads like a movie rather than anything else.
Yeah, we as documentary makers are almost blessed. Our cup runneth over with plot points, a narrative and drama. And what's amazing about some of the drama in the FIFA story, and like you say, you know, a screenwriter couldn't have done it better. This all happened very publicly. This happened under people's noses. The issue was because FIFA as an organization is not as interesting as the action on the pitch, that it kind of went unreported. For a small minority of people, you know, a handful of sports journalists and people who are really in the weeds with this topic, they knew all of this was happening. But for us, you know, and when I say us, I include myself, the sports watching public, you know, we didn't really cotton on to the fact that fighter jets were being tossed around for votes, or that people were being caught with brown envelopes, or that gas deals were being done. And like you say, there isn't a cinematic element to the way that people rise and fall. I've heard a lot of people referring us, you know, the FIFA story to Game of Thrones or House of Cards, and just the sheer political maneuvering. A lot of the stories that we tell are kind of almost Shakespearean in their sense that it's about rises and falls, very human traits where people get too ambitious, too greedy, and end up collapsing under the weight of their own ambition.
Did it really get supercharged under Sepp Blatter in that way?
Absolutely. Blatter inherited an organization in 1998 that is in the ascendancy, both financially, politically. He also inherits an organization that's opening up new territories. In 1994, the US has the World Cup for the first time. The amount of teams participating in the World Cup is expanding. And really what we see is that football as a global game starts having an enormous amount of money pumped into it. I'm sure a lot of your listeners in New Zealand, if they cast their minds back to, you know, the mid and early 90s, they probably don't remember soccer being a huge part of their life. It wasn't on TV around the world. And then suddenly in the middle of the 90s and when Blatter takes over in 98, it becomes a huge deal. You know, you start seeing football clubs like Manchester United becoming global brands. Manchester United today has tire partners, noodle partners, manufacturing partners, an official airline. That era of sports branding goes into hyperdrive. Just when Blatter is getting his feet under the table, just when the most ambitious man in sports political history has taken the reins. And what Blatter starts doing is almost running FIFA on a kind of credit card system where he's selling the rights for tournaments many years in advance in order to keep the money flowing in order to not just to keep the lights on, but to turn FIFA into a multi-billion dollar empire. And for the first part, it goes relatively well. There are some sort of setbacks, there are some stumbles, but basically Blatter in his early tenure begins to get the sense that he can do no wrong, that he's King Midas, everything he's touching turns to gold, which might explain in some ways the psychology behind him overlooking certain details and certainly turning a blind eye to people in his organization who aren't doing so well.
He himself also gets mired in controversy again and again. Talk us through some of the ways that this played out, and especially towards, I suppose, the hosting rights.
So one of the biggest decisions FIFA has is where to put the World Cup. And when I say the World Cup, I do really refer to the Men's World Cup. I say that with no joy, but the Women's World Cup has never been as lucrative as the Men's World Cup. And it's funny, for many years, it was only men who voted on the location of the Women's World Cup. It was very much an afterthought, where the crown jewel in FIFA's, in sort of the Tower Bridge of FIFA, is the Men's World Cup. And where it goes is a huge political token to be handed out to supporters or allies. It's a very coveted prize. Countries want to host it for you know, amazing image building reasons. They want to host it for sporting reasons. And the way that FIFA decides who gets to host that prize, I should add, countries very rarely make money off it. It is often a loss leader reputationally. But the way that FIFA decides who gets to host it is a slightly archaic system, or at least it was until for very many years, up until 2016. It was an executive committee of all men, 24 men, including Sepp Blatter as president. And it was, you know, one man, one vote. And for very many years, Sepp Blatter kept his executive committee on a very tight rein, ensuring that it would go, that they would give the World Cup to the country he wanted it to go to. But in quite a few occasions, he struggled. One very famous example, which might be familiar to New Zealander listeners, would be the rights for the 2006 World Cup. Blatter was elected on a promise that he would bring the World Cup to Africa, specifically South Africa. When South Africa went head-to-head with Germany, it was deadlocked. And a New Zealand voter by the name of Charlie Dempsey was the person who was supposed to vote for South Africa and break the deadlock, but ended up abstaining, much to Blatter's chagrin. and Germany won the rights to host the 2006 World Cup. And so what Blatter learned in very early on, so that was 2 years into his presidency, that the FIFA World Cup hosting right was probably the biggest political event of every 4 years, and he needed to keep an eye on it. And in the case of Qatar and Russia, he did not want the World Cup to go to Qatar. He did want it to go to Russia, but he wanted it to go to Russia and the US. He thought that just on a sort of superficial image building level, this would make him eligible for a Nobel Peace Prize as the man who sort of, and I mean, this is really true, this is what he thought, would sort of thaw the Cold War once and for all and unite these two enemies. So he was playing this, you know, incredibly delicate political balancing act where he had to appease these 24 very power-hungry men, you know, men who were often at the executive committee level, not because they've been lovely sports administrators, but because they've known how to cut a deal or two in their time. And Blatter's job was to kind of compete all those balancing interests and make sure that Blatter's interests came out on top at the end. And he probably failed in doing that at the most important moment.
Yes, because, of course, there were eyebrows raised when Qatar did get those hosting rights.
Absolutely. When that vote was announced, well, first we found out Russia were going to win 2018, and that was a small eyebrow raise. People thought there were better bids. The Dutch and Belgian bid, for example, was going to be the first ever green World Cup. England, where I'm calling from, thought that they had a pretty good reason to host the World Cup as the quote-unquote spiritual home of football, although many people in around the world dispute that heavily. But basically, when Russia won, it sort of made people a bit uncomfortable, but they thought, you know, there's a reason for it to go there. Blatter certainly wanted to go there. When Blatter read out Qatar, the entire footballing press just collectively had a jaw drop moment. There was a stunned silence, broken only by the cheers of the Qataris. Many people didn't give Qatar a chance of winning more than two or three votes, and here they had won the whole thing. To those in the room, and we spoke to many people about this, the overwhelming consensus was this was the beginning of the end for FIFA. They had crossed the Rubicon, and what had previously been a sort of a secret, an open secret within FIFA, but a secret nevertheless, that there had been financial deals taking place behind the scenes. Their feeling was it was now out in the open, that Qatar was as close as we'd ever get to a smoking gun.
Mm. Why did Qatar want this so much?
I love that question because I think people assume they know why Qatar want it, but I think the reality is much deeper and much more complex. So I think the general popular assumption is that Qatar want to be loved, and that's why they and many other countries sports wash. That they just want to have a sort of a positive feeling of goodwill towards them internationally. And I think that's a part of it, but it's no more than 10%. The reason Qatar wanted to host the World Cup is nothing short of basically an issue of national security. So let's take your listeners to Qatar. We're talking about a very small peninsula with a lot of natural gas, bordered by only one country, Saudi Arabia, in terms of land. Saudi Arabia dwarfed them. Next to them, you've got the UAE, again, much bigger. And across the water, you've got Iran. You've got these three very wealthy countries that have far bigger populations. There are only about 300,000 Qataris. And these are three countries that made their money on oil, which is running out, looking at Qatar with their natural gas and wondering if they might ever get a piece of that. Qatar is now, of course, the wealthiest country in the world per capita. So if you're the emir of Qatar and you can't compete with these three mega powers in terms of military, you'll never have more soldiers than them. And you look across the water at a country like Kuwait, which was, of course, invaded by Saddam, and then the US stepped in to repel an attack. You start asking yourself, how can I ensure that my country cannot be invaded and my ruling family cannot be toppled? How can I ensure that I have the support of the Western world? And this is where it goes far beyond goodwill, because goodwill is all very, you know, very nice, but it's not going to step in militarily. The first way is you host a military base, and they did that. The second way is you try and figure out a very sophisticated way of making your sovereignty unviolatable. That's the word. And sports is an incredibly good way of doing this. Qatar transformed in just, you know, with that opening of an envelope from being a country that no one had heard about to a country that everyone on the planet has heard of. Qatar's sovereignty is sort of beyond question at this point. It's one of the finest markers of a defined nation state to host a sporting tournament. But more than that, what Qatar are trying to do with this World Cup is attract foreign investment, foreign expats to come live there. They've spent more money entertaining British MPs than ever before in their history. They're flying out VIPs and even, get this, VVIPs. When we were out in Qatar, we were shown to the VVIP route, where heads of state and ministers and billionaires would be entertained all while watching the game if they wanted to. They could watch it live or on the flat screen TVs in their booth. And that's what Qatar had their eyes on. They wanted to make sure that they have infrastructure and foreign interests embedded in their nation so that Saudi and Iran and UAE and all these countries that are basically very unfriendly towards Qatar could never, ever invade without incurring the wrath of the US. And if this sounds conspiratorial or sort of tin hat, I can assure your listeners it really is what's happening. That's what experts on the ground, that's what Qataris told us. It really is that high level. It's not as simple as we want to put on a party for the world. If they wanted to put on a party for the world, they wouldn't ban beer and they wouldn't ban rainbow flags. This is about a regional and international show of force.
An incredible interview as well within the documentary with Sepp Blatter. Did that surprise you at how candid he was, that he agreed to be interviewed in the first place?
You know, what's funny about that is I personally spoke to about maybe 300-400 people in the making of this show, of which 100-odd did interviews, maybe 30 or 40 were used in the final thing. That's sort of just all part of the process. And some of those people took 2 and a bit years to be convinced to do an interview. Some of those people were never convinced to do an interview. Sepp Blatter didn't take 2 years to be convinced. He took about 2 minutes. And the reason for that is, if you giving Sepp Blatter a camera and a microphone is like giving a carpenter a saw and a hammer. Sepp Blatter has made his reputation and his career on speaking, on convincing, on persuading and charming. And as far as he is concerned, he has done nothing wrong. He's never been found guilty of a crime. As far as he is concerned, football, world football, is in a far better place than when he found it. And as far as he is concerned, he's beloved, not in Europe so much, but in the rest of the world, in places like Africa, Asia, Latin America. And so why did he agree to speak so quickly? Well, he thinks he's got a great story to tell, but also, to be frank, I think he really enjoys the limelight and perhaps misses it a little bit. And I wasn't surprised by his candidness, but there were certain things that came out that even, you know, when I was in the room listening to them, I just couldn't believe that he was speaking so freely about specific details that hadn't really come out before.
What were some of those areas that particularly made your, you know, piqued your interest, made your ears prick up?
I think the one that will stay with me is a story that he told about what happened after Qatar won the World Cup. So when Qatar won the World Cup, Sepp Blatter was, for the first time in his reign, truly vulnerable. He hadn't got his way. And one of the most prominent critics of Blatter, one of the big, strongest rivals he had, was a Qatari called Mohammed bin Hammam, who had sort of been behind the scenes, involved with the bid at the later stages. And when Qatar won the right to host the World Cup, bin Hammam thought that he had a shot of unseating Blatter. And many people thought that this would never have been possible, but bin Hammam thought, I'm going to give it a go, and orchestrated a campaign against Blatter. And then the story that Blatter tells us, and he'd never told anyone on a camera this publicly before, was that he started undermining the Qatari World Cup. He basically was giving statements in public saying that Qatar wasn't suitable, and, you know, in a dog whistle way, threatening to take the World Cup away from Qatar. And Blatter admitted that he called a meeting with the son of the emir, his rival, bin Hammam, and they sat down and cut a deal, which was, if bin Hammam withdraws his candidacy, I will withdraw my complaints about the Qatar World Cup and it will go ahead. Bin Hammam, as a sort of non-royal Qatari citizen, was pretty much obliged to follow this deal. This is precisely what happened. He withdrew his candidacy and Blatter kept the World Cup in Qatar. This was really important. And if you think just back to 2 or 3 weeks ago, Blatter came out just before the World Cup and said that the World Cup being hosted in Qatar was a mistake. That was his quote. Yet he had told our cameras not long before this that he'd kept the World Cup in Qatar, that he'd done so not because he thought it was the right place for football or because he thought the stadiums were lovely or anything like that. He'd done it to save his own skin politically. And it was little details like that that I, you know, will leave one's jaw on the floor. Even after 3 years of research, there are still things that can surprise you in this story.
Indeed. And of course, many household names also becoming enmeshed in all of this. Adidas, I suppose, a specific one, becoming enmeshed and sort of drawn into all of this corruption as well.
Absolutely. Well, Adidas themselves will be very quick to point out that they've never been accused of something like this. The story is that the son of the Adidas founder, a man who would later go on to lead Adidas, by the name of Horst Dassler, first got together with FIFA in a sort of marketing capacity and made Adidas an official partner. In doing so, he helped fund FIFA. You know, the partnership and the sponsorship with Adidas earned FIFA a lot of money. And Dassler himself spotted an opportunity that sports rights were undervalued, you know, the actual television rights for football. And Dassler set up a sister company. This was called ISL, and ISL has been linked to many millions of dollars of bribes paid to FIFA executives over many years. And ISL actually ended up going bankrupt, partly because it was just couldn't afford the bribes it was paying, as ludicrous as that sounds. So while Adidas never themselves have been accused of paying bribes, there is certainly murkiness around them. And what is fascinating to me, and I would encourage your listeners to do this, turn on the World Cup and see how much Adidas you still see today. Adidas's fortunes as a company are inextricably linked to FIFA and the rise of FIFA. And it's a relationship that goes back 50 years to the very first days of Havelange's presidency.
Is an absolutely fascinating tale. Thank you very much, Miles Coleman, for joining us with all of that. Writer and producer of FIFA Uncovered, that is available to watch on Netflix, an extraordinary expose there. Thank you very much for your time on 9 to Noon this morning.